time. Hello, listeners, fans of My Internet Has Stopped Working podcast. We are what's left of the podcasters of the apocalypse.
Mass exodus.
Mass exodus. We are busy as the second session of courses rolls out here at Gonzaga University. So we are down to three of us today. Myself, Justin, Marcus Marquis. Isn't that one of the guys?
Sure, yeah.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, at least you didn't say you were Terry, because,
whew. Oh, I was going to say Terry, but I forgot his name.
Oh, yeah. That's a bad choice.
Justin, I'm not Terry. Me too, Marquis.
Good. I like the juxtaposition. It's uncanny. My name is Britt Herland Harmon.
I forgot to get myself a name. We're just going to throw out
Bobina.
Rena Bobina.
When in doubt, just throw that in there.
Yes. Just make up a name, because that's what the women in this book that we have not introduced yet.
I've been expecting you. Oh, forgive me. We haven't been formally introduced, have we?
So, the nicknames will make more sense now that we have said we read Herland by Charlotte Perkins Gilman. What some of our group may not know is actually it's a part of a trilogy, this book. Surprise, Rena. Rena's looking at me.
One book for each of the three of us appearing
today. Yeah. Did you know your assignment was actually to read a different book?
I did not.
So, it is called the Herland Trilogy. It starts with Moving the Mountain. The second book is Herland, and it finishes with her in our land. It doesn't roll off the tongue.
Which is the equivalent of Escape from the Planet of the Apes.
It sounds like it. I'm going to let you know that I read, actually, from a book that includes the trilogy. I first read it in college from this really beautiful illustrated version that had a map of Herland in it, and I made the unfortunate choice of lending it to a friend and never got it back. And can't remember which friend I lent it to. Very poor choice.
If everything's ready here on the dark side of the moon, play the five tones.
But yeah, so maybe we should start with, before I dive into the what's written on the back of my copy, when did you first hear of or encounter or read this work? Like I said, college. I encountered this book in a course on political socialism, and it was among a collection of your like typical treatises by old guys, Karl Marx, etc. And there was this gem in there, Herland, on, you know, utopian feminism.
Karl Marx wrote some good stuff too.
He did, you know. But it was nice to have a female author in there. I was surprised. And I've since read it. This is my fifth read.
Wow.
Next.
First encounter.
I was the last time that we recorded. I had actually never heard the title before.
Awesome.
When was it? I should have looked.
Oh, yeah. It was written in 1915.
Oh, 15.
That late.
Wow.
Interesting.
Okay.
So for me, I found this interesting because this is a book that has been circulating around the periphery of my life for a long time. Read The Yellow Wallpaper, also by Charlotte Perkins Gilman, in grad school. In undergrad, because I was an English major. I don't remember what class we read it in, but definitely had to read it. And then my wife has on and off talked about a book she loved in high school about a country of only women. And we could never figure out what it was. And then I was like, oh, this is
And I brought it up. Book. And like, that book.
That's the one. And then she did not want to join us on the podcast. Oh, she's too busy. But I'm excited to have read it. This was the first time I read it, even though, again, it's been like orbiting my life for years.
It was meant to be.
All right. Plan 9 from Outer Space. Which version edition are you reading? And if we have the dust jacket. My version is in my office if you'd like me to go grab it.
Yeah, you can go ahead and get it. Like I said, I read the trilogy collection, and it talks about all three of the books, but I think it just says, Herland is a utopian novel. I would say feminist utopian novel. The book describes an isolated society composed entirely of women who reproduce via parthenogenesis. That's a $10 word. The resultant is an ideal social order free of war, conflict, and domination. The story is told from the perspective of Van Jennings, a student of sociology, along with two friends, T. Terry O. Nicholson, problematic guy, and Jeff Margrave forms an expedition party to explore an area of uncharted land where it is rumored lives a society consisting entirely of women. The three friends do not really believe the rumors, as they are unable to conceive of how human reproduction could occur without males. The men speculate about what a society of women would be like, each guessing differently based on the stereotype of women which he holds most dear. I thought it was a good description.
Yeah. And what edition was that?
Oh, this is just a trilogy. It's like an e-print, like an e-book print.
This book is in the public domain.
Yeah, it is in the public domain. So it was an e-book copy that just included three of these works all together.
Nice.
Yeah.
I just did the one that was available on Libby through the library, so I am not sure what...
You have no dust jacket. It is digital.
It was very plain. It was just a burgundy cover with a gold...
Yeah, that's their standard default
frame. Cover. Yeah, mm-hmm. And then just said Herland.
Yeah, it's old enough to be in the public domain now. So.
It is. So I have the Dover Thrift Edition, which we bought for my oldest child, who is an English major here at Gonzaga. It's a 1998 print version by Dover. And the dust jacket says, "A prominent turn of the century social critic and lecturer, Charlotte Perkins Gilman is perhaps best known for her short story, The Yellow Wallpaper, mm-hmm. a chilling study of a woman's descent into insanity, and Women in Economics, a classic of feminist theory that analyzes the destructive effects of women's economic reliance on men. In Herland, a vision of a feminist utopia, Gilman employs humor and to the engaging effect in a story about three male explorers who stumble upon an all-female society isolated somewhere in South America. Noting the advanced state of the civilization they've encountered, the visitors set out to find some males." That doesn't make any sense. "Oh, the visitors set out to find some males, assuming that since the country is so civilized, there must be men. A delightful fantasy, the story enables Gilman to articulate her then unconventional views of male-female roles and capabilities, motherhood, individuality, privacy, a sense of community, sexuality, and many other topics." I read that. Well, I had that. I mainly listened to it online because it's in the public domain. So I found it on YouTube.
Yeah.
With a bunch of different narrators and then on the Google Books Project. So we'll put the links to those in the description of the podcast so anybody can access those.
Yeah.
Should you like to read it and don't have a library.
Yeah. Awesome.
First of all, it was October, a rare month for boys. Full of cold winds, long nights, dark promises. Days get short, the shadows lengthen. And the wind mourns in such a way you want to run forever through the field.
So the next piece is player attributes. Who wrote it and why? So Charlotte Perkins Gilman wrote this, I'm going to call it a novella, it's very short. It was written in 1915 at the end of an era that was considered to be the first wave of feminism in the United States, which began in 1848 with the Seneca Falls Convention. And it ended 5 years after Herland was written with women gaining the right to vote in 1920. So it was right at the right before women gained the right to vote. This novella is considered to be a response by Charlotte to the stereotypical and inflexible gender roles of society and it's a reimagining of the contributions of women and its effects on society. Should they be considered as capable in holding power equal to men? Her imagining of it. This text is considered to be a feminist manifesto of sorts through the lens of a fictional land. Charlotte was generally famous for her, quote unquote, I'm using quotes, unconventional personal life as a journalist, having a working profession, and a feminist intellectual. Part of what made her unconventional, I did a little research, she did marry and have a daughter, which was very conventional. But after becoming a mother, she suffered from what we now would call postpartum depression severely. And she kind of ceded the care of her child to who became her ex-husband and his second wife and other family members, citing her powerlessness that she felt as a wife and mother and being part of a culture that didn't take her needs or thoughts seriously. Which is like, yeah.
Wallpaper.
Yeah. She was quoted in some of her letters talking about how she was appreciative of her ex-husband's second wife in like taking on mothering duties for her. So like an awareness of appreciation for other women in a situation that was very unconventional at the time. her great aunt was Harriet Beecher Stowe. So considered to have a big influence on her in her writing career, inspiring her literary pursuits as a woman. Charlotte argued a great deal for financial independence of women and that it could only benefit society as a whole, which I found to be a very modern argument that is still put forward today. Famous for her short story, The Yellow Wallpaper, which to me, I remember reading, it was mind-blowing. Text demonstrating the challenges of mental health for women and the abusive nature of the rest cure, which was a very popular health remedy at the time for women recovering from what was considered to be female hysteria brought on by motherhood and the expectations of society. So a lot of stuff going on. That's her, Charlotte.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Huh.
This is the world that you know. The world as it was at the end of the 20th century. It exists now only as part of a neural interactive simulation that we call the Matrix.
Ooh, I'm curious to see what everyone thinks about this data analysis, the main point of the book and the structure and format. Mm-hmm. What did you guys feel about the whole, like, it's written from the perspective of a man, which mm-hmm. it's a feminist utopian novel. Mm-hmm. So the first time I was like, oh, it's like a male voice, the whole mm-hmm. thing. But it's like a documentary of his exploration.
Yeah. It strikes me a little bit like Tarzan.
Yes.
Tarzan books. Who wrote those? Why am I drawing a complete blank on who wrote Tarzan? Oh my goodness. Or also like it fits in the same time period as like H.G. Wells and...
Edgar Rice Burroughs.
Edgar Rice Burroughs, yeah, right. Yeah, so it fits that kind of genre, Joseph Conrad kind of feel. Feels a lot like Joseph Conrad to me.
Hmm.
So I think the structure is incredibly straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
We have dudes on an adventure in a strange place with savage peoples.
Mm-hmm. Use of savages.
And they hear a story of a magical other place. So they, of course, because they're white men, can find the magical other place when 2,000 years of the local people have been unable to find this other place. Takes them about a minute and a half. I think it was 3 pages in the book. To build a biplane that they've kept in their backpack and fly up and find this magical place. And everybody is both surprised and delighted that they have arrived. Because, of course, these women have been waiting for men, at least according
to this whole time. Yeah, desperately.
Yep. And then, of course, things go south and they have one of them at least has to leave. So, you know, spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert.
Men show up where there are women. Men do bad things. Men go bye-bye. I think that's the whole structure.
That is the structure. Yeah.
It had a very, I didn't realize, I didn't check the copyrighted when it was originally written, but it had a very nondescript timelessness to it in that it kind of could have been the Amazon, you know, that when they're talking about trying to find their way through mm-hmm. the maze of waterways. But just almost a treasure hunter kind of thing, mm-hmm. you know, back to your point. Well, like nobody else can find it, but we will. And going back and being very secretive about going mm-hmm. to, yeah.
They only wanted to get credit, so they came back on their own.
But there was never any clear sense of exactly where they were at in their search for this place.
Yeah, and I remember when I read this the first time, I almost was like, ooh, this could be real. You know, that's so cool. Because it would, like, they never talk about where it's located. Van specifically doesn't give any identifying markers from what they can see from this like, you know, elevated landscape, what they can see from either direction or what body of water that got cut off in the great like lava flow or whatever. So obviously technologically it's not really possible to have a place hidden unless, you know, it's like Dune and there's
planets.
It's on another planet, and also, you know, it's got satellites protecting it from, you know,
being hidden. Yeah.
Being monitored.
Yeah. Strangely, I know it was South America, but I always felt like it was someplace, because I pictured the women as completely Aryan, and I was imagining it was someplace in Europe that magically get cut off from everybody else.
It's very Aryan. Yeah, I know. I always forget, because you said South America because of your dust jacket, but I always assume it's in, like, some
Nordic somewhere.
Yeah, high valley. Balkan, like Eastern European, like plateau high above the clouds.
Like a secret, like the Valley of Lost Dinosaurs or something. Yes.
Yes. It's like Jurassic Park, but people
behind a curtain of ivy. Yeah.
So part of this section is, what's the point of the book?
I really do think that the point of the book was to get people to, in a realistic way, imagine what women could contribute to society, honestly. True. Because I don't think it was in people's purview. It was just unbelievable, not even possible. But the way that she writes it out.
Imaginable.
Yeah. So the way that she writes it out is like, if you put women in a room, those guys thought they were just squabble. It's not possible. Mm-hmm. It'd be just like
which a they literally say in the book. Yes.
Right. But no, it would be organized. It'd be, you know, you take it or leave it, maternal.
Yeah.
It'd be utopian. It would be very focused on growth and development and care. It would be nonviolent. Mm-hmm. You know, there are no struggle, no pain,
no criminals.
Yeah. So I think that she was giving people an opportunity to imagine something that for her, she could completely see in her mind's eye, despite all the problematic other pieces, which we'll talk about later. But I think that was the purpose.
If you can imagine, cultural anthropology class that I took in college had a book of just a lot of different anthropologists, either papers or different situations in all different span of cultures. And one of them was written in such a way that it described a culture where there was a temple that was all ran by women, and the workers in this temple, these women, all wore these white robes and were allowed to administer healing substances to someone who was ill, but family members and the spouse of this person would not be allowed to interact with their, you know, all decisions would be taken away. And as you got towards the end of it, you realize what they were describing was going into the hospital.
Oh.
And so if you were to look at this from an alien's perspective and completely strip away all of the cultural norms or expectations or stereotype that is typical of women, and just look at it, that's the lens I looked at, and how incredulous Terry was. It's like, well, of course there's men, you know, because there's this, and not being able to fathom the ability to, like, no judicial system, but
it's a kernel.
Just
didn't need any of it.
But clearly a hierarchy in there, and of some some fashion, but a very functioning one. There was no squabbling or subterfuge. Anyway, it was an interesting way to read it, to look at it from a perspective of, like, say, an alien who came down here and had no preconceived notion of what a feminine culture would be.
Which is cool, because that's also what they do when they're asking questions of the men about their world. They're collecting all of the subtext, too, that they're avoiding saying throughout the book, which I find hilarious. Oh, my gosh.
So I did not read the other two books. Are there men in... Oh, obviously, there's a men in the third book.
Yes.
Are there men in the first book?
Yes.
Huh. Okay. Is it, like, the pre, before the,
yeah,
the
so, isolation? So this actually gives a... Moving the Mountain, which is the first book in Charlotte Perkins Gilman's well-known trilogy, Moving Mountain delivers Gilman's program for reforming society. She concentrates on measures of rationality and efficiency that could be instituted in her own time, largely with greater social cooperation, equal education and treatment for girls and boys, daycare centers for working women, and other issues still relevant a century later. So it's kind of like reforming her own society in her time. Her imagined utopian version of her society still in her time, because it's not futuristic at all. It is just within her own time. And then followed by, what is it called? With Her in Our Land is, Van brings, what is his person's name?
Their names are all...
Elidor. So Van brings Elidor to the outside world, and that is that adventure, that journey is the third book, With Her in Our Land.
Just wondering, did they need men? I understand why there are men in this book. Because that presents the source of conflict.
Yes.
You kind of have conflict in a book. I was wondering what the book would be like without men. Would it just be an essay where she just catalogs all of the good of this kind of land?
Yeah, I think it would have just, I mean, it would probably have been a little less interesting, which is funny because there's that section in the book where they talk about how their drama is super boring because mm-hmm. there's no passion, no conflict, no right. tragedy, you know, nothing, mm-hmm. no catalyst. Yeah. You know, it is just expository, kind mm-hmm. of, like, let's talk about our world. Let's talk about
the... Let's make things better.
Yeah. Kind of like passion plays. It just mm-hmm. talks about their history a lot. So that's why the men thought their drama was boring. But that also probably would be why the book wouldn't have been as interesting.
Right.
Because it would have just been a treatise on her land, mm-hmm. you know. Yeah. Who knows what it would have been called. They probably wouldn't have called it her land because they don't have gender linguistic gender signifiers because there was no gender. They're just mm-hmm. people, all the same people.
People land.
Yeah, people land. Person land.
Person.
They land.
Oh, Hal, do you read me? Do you read me, Hal?
Affirmative, Dave. I read you.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Heroes and villains?
Heroes and villains.
Three dudes and the 3 million women.
There's a clear villain, and it's Terry.
Poor Terry.
Terry was annoying. Question.
I would like to argue that Terry is not the villain. He's the victim.
Oh, yeah. You are going to get kicked out of this podcast. There are two women here. Get out of her land. Get out of here.
Been voted off of the her land.
We're sending you down in that weird copter thing.
Yeah. How about the other two men?
I thought that Jeff was also obnoxious in his own way, and they were put on a spectrum, right?
Right.
Very obviously.
And Jeff was, what was his profession? Was he the engineer?
No.
Was Terry?
The doctor.
He was the doctor.
Terry was the engineer.
Terry's was more of the engineer, the yeah. wealthy entrepreneur right. explorer guy, the one who had his backing.
Plane.
Yeah. And then
his yacht. And his
then
pocket.
Van was the sociologist. Van. So, you know, Jeff.
Van's not the hero.
No. Van was neutral.
Mm-hmm.
He was
a foil.
He was inquisitive, you know, open to change. Interested, but also he wasn't super bigoted. And, you know, I called Terry like the bro, you know, the explorer bro, the toxic explorer bro.
Toxic explorer, T-E-B.
T-E-B. And then Jeff was the female idolizer, you know, put them on a pedestal. You're precious, you're revered. And yeah. they didn't want to be babied. They were infantilized. He's very infantilizing.
Yeah. More traditional man.
Yeah. It's like, you're precious as gold. You don't need to work. And they're like,
and
what
Van
the
was
fuck?
A sociologist.
And Van was a sociologist, yeah. So he was,
had
I think, able to
look.
Yes, yes, take a step back and kind of analyze things from a neutral perspective sometimes, mm-hmm. though there were times he did not.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, they were all punks at one point. You know,
yeah.
Because, like, okay, we're fine here. No, we're going to escape. Oh, okay.
I guess we'll go because we don't want to leave you by yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we'll get to those parts. Strangely and poorly written.
Oh.
The heroes, the entire women population, or particular women heroes?
There's three teachers. Like, the three teachers that they had.
Teachers are built up in this.
Were, I think, the Terry's teachers, the one he calls her so many mean names. Sound like the most patient, saintliest human on the planet. Can you imagine?
Well, they were so unflappable. Nothing stunned them.
Mm-hmm.
The behaviors, the men's behavior or questions, nothing came as a surprise to them, and they answered them in a very pragmatic or just a matter-of-fact sort of way.
Yeah. With the structure of their society, you know, the teachers of children... Because there's a difference between being one of the people who can physically have a child, but then a separate job, the most important job, yep. other than that, was the people who get to raise and care for and teach the children, not even obviously teach them by living, right? I was wondering, and it isn't obvious, but if the three teachers that they had teaching the men, like trying to get them to understand their world, because they have this goal of maybe bringing back in the, you know, sexual reproduction, right? This potential future. They tapped like their three best teachers to teach these three people, you know, because this was a, you know, something that they'd been thinking about as a possibility for time immemorial, but they had no way to connect to the outside world again. So when the opportunity presented itself, they tapped it like three best teachers of children to do that. But I don't know.
I did have a quote about that that was from Word Processor of the Gods section.
Ooh, tell me, yes. Time. Yeah.
I did not write down which chapter it was from. But here we go. But I thought motherhood was for each of you. Motherhood, yes, that is maternity, to bear a child. But education is our highest art, only allowed to our highest artists. Education, I was puzzled again. I don't mean education, I mean by motherhood not only childbearing, but the care of babies. The care of babies involves education and is entrusted only to the most fit, she repeated.
Mm-hmm. If only our society thought that, mm-hmm. you know, and invested in that and, like, demonstrated that importance, right?
Well, yeah, keep people dumb. Because then you can control them.
Yeah.
About Karl Marx.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the three teacher women.
Yes.
I think that's fair.
I thought they were the ultimate heroes. Even down to the wire, mm-hmm. they're the most heroic.
Anything else to add about characters? It's really a pretty, despite being 3 million women deep, it was a pretty lean cast.
Yeah. I mean, there was the three girls. They called them the three girls, like, the whole time.
The ones that they originally met in the forest.
Yes. Yeah. Giggling in the trees, you know. so they were characters. But I think what was very interesting about that was they all, even though there were some characters with names, they were all very 2D. Mm-hmm. You know, they were all well-educated, thoughtful, very kind, very patient, mm-hmm. so much so that it was almost like they had no personality.
Yeah.
So I think that, very, very eugenics, you know, eugenics-y, which will come up later, you know, pseudoscience there. You know, how do we create the best humans, the best women? They're quiet and patient and
demure.
And yeah.
Dress well.
And yeah, but they also do all these other things like right. hard work. They're physically like really strong and capable. So it was a mix of things that I would consider feminist and then also a mix of things that I was like, ooh, you know, when mm-hmm. I think of feminism, I think outspoken, passionate, intense, loud, you know, all those other things.
Did you quiet down?
Yeah. But so yeah. I thought because of that, I always have, every time I've read this book, I've had trouble remembering who the women are. And it's because they are an entity.
Mm-hmm. They're ants.
Yeah.
And they are categorized as ants.
They're part of a hive mind. Yes. Yeah. In my written, like, because I always like reading a hard copy, because I always take notes every time I read this, I was like, hive mind, mm-hmm. you know, communal brain.
Yep.
You know?
Which could, that throws it into the sci-fi realm.
It does. It does.
Yeah, well, I told the captain I'd have this analysis done in an hour.
How long would it really take? An hour? Oh, you didn't tell him how long it would really take, did you?
Well, of course I did.
Oh, laddie, you've got a lot to learn if you want people to think of you as a miracle worker.
We're ready to talk about science?
Oh, yeah. Mine was mostly about pseudoscience, but yeah.
We'll come to pseudo. I want to talk about the real science first.
You talk about the real science, because I got too distracted by pseudoscience.
Fake science.
Mm-hmm.
Parthenogenesis.
As
you butchered her.
I talked about the president.
I found some interesting stuff on parthenogenesis.
Okay.
I wrote it all down, so I'm just going to read some of it because it's fairly interesting.
Yeah, I need to hear it. I know there are animals that do it.
There are, but no mammals. Parthenogenesis is an asexual reproduction in which a female can produce an embryo without fertilizing an egg with sperm. In Greek, it means the virgin creation. It occurs naturally in some jawed vertebrates, such as the whip-tailed lizards, but in mammals, it is an unnatural event.
Ooh.
However, parthenogenesis may not be a rare event in humans as we thought, but it may occur spontaneously, resulting in the formation of teratoma of the ovary. The second oocyte, which is ovulated at each ovarian cycle, usually stops in metaphase 2 until it is fertilized by the sperm. Once the sperm enters the oocyte, the egg completes meiosis 2 to form the ovum, whose nucleus fuses with the sperm nucleus to form the zygote. This process is called sexual reproduction. However, under idiopathic abnormal circumstances, a spontaneous exit of the oocyte with metaphase 2 could occur without apparent stimulation. This is known as oocyte spontaneous activation. Such spontaneous parthenogenic activation may occur in human oocytes, but mostly lead to tumor formation, including ovarian teratoma. Some authors postulate that parthenogenesis occurs in humans through the formation of OT2s. However, they did not explain how this could happen, although reproduction in most mammals occurs through the mating between male and female. It has been hypothesized that the presence of rare cases in parthenogenesis, humans that result in normal and viable individuals go unnoticed due to the absence of congenital anomalies. So they're saying it could actually happen. Parthenogenetic activation by artificial manipulation has been conducted in mice with the creation of an early stage of fetal development. However, other authors stated that the creation and birth of the animal through oocyte parthenogenetic activation using genetic modification technologies is possible. So it is possible. The times it has been noted are when it causes a problem.
Yeah.
Basically causes cancer. But they are speculating, and this is a 2023 Scientific Journal article that I read, that it could happen and could go unnoticed by us. So I found that kind of interesting.
That's futuristic for 1915?
Yeah, that's pretty darn William Gibson of her. Mm.
Yeah. So I really felt how futuristic and amazing this would have been in real life for women in the world who had no access to birth control, mm-hmm. you know, whose only form of birth control would be
hard work.
Hard work in her land. Wouldn't that be cool? Just to not think about it in her land. That's your birth control. Excellent. But you know, in a world where sex equals kids, you know, for most women, yep. you had no choice. You couldn't socially, it was unacceptable to like turn down, say no to your husband, you know, things like that.
You're not legally allowed to say no.
It's yeah. Legal. And apparently it's okay for you to be raped because you're their wife. Right. So that's okay. And we'll get more on that later. If you haven't read the book, dear listeners, I apologize in advance. Trigger warning. I feel like Charlotte was dreamscape. Like that, wouldn't that be in a world where you don't have access to the pill or all the options that we have nowadays? How amazing would it have been to live in a world where this was possible? And part of me just like felt for women that go back in time and just feel for them. Mm-hmm. It's like you're probably going to die from childbirth because you have no choice. You just have them until you can't, and you can't because you're dead. Yep. Sucks.
I'm going to be quiet because I haven't had any.
Got a couple of moms over here, and we're just like, that shit's real. Okay. It doesn't bullshit.
You wouldn't have any kids if hard work stopped.
So. I don't know. It was a choice, though. Like, it was a choice I got to make in my mid-30s, which is, like, not a thing in this era. It's amazing, you know? And I got to get degrees and everything.
I had one other scientific...
Oh, yeah, before we transition to pseudoscience.
Yes. Game-based learning. I'm an instructional designer.
God, yes!
There's a huge chunk of game-based learning in here. I, of course, snagged it and stuck it in here.
Yes, please read those quotes.
The children seemed always playing something or else sometimes engaged in peaceful researches of their own. I had wondered at first when they went to school, but soon found that they never did. To their knowledge, it was all education but no schooling. We have been working for some 1,600 years devising better and better games for children, continued Sommel. I sat aghast. Devising games? I protested. Making up new ones, you mean? Exactly, she answered. Don't you? Then I remembered the kindergarten and the material devised by Signora Montessori. That's Maria Montessori. And guardedly replied, to some extent, but most of our games, I told her, were very old, came down from child to child along the ages from the remote past. And what is their effect, she asked. Do they develop the faculties you wish to encourage? Again, I remembered the claims made by the advocates of sports, and again replied guardedly that that was, in part, the theory. But do the children like it, I asked, having things made up and set before them that way? Don't they want the old games? You can see the children, she answered. Are yours more contented, more interested, happier? Then I thought, as in truth I never had thought before, of the dull, bored children I had seen, whining, what can I do now? Of the little groups and gangs hanging about, of the value of some one strong spirit who possessed initiative and would start something, of the children's parties and the onerous duties of the older people set to amuse the children, also of that troubled ocean of misdirected activity we called mischief, the foolish, destructive, sometimes evil things done by unoccupied children. Love it. An entire society built on gamification and game-based learning. And it's super effective and everybody's smart and everybody understands all the basic stuff and everybody is allowed to diversify into whatever field of specialization they want based on this broad general understanding.
So it's not just like a feminist utopia, it's an instructional design and delivery utopia.
It is. It's an IDDtopia.
I love it. That part makes me laugh. I reread it and chuckled. It's like thinking about, even me as a parent, it made me laugh because you're always like, you know, oh, go play. And they're like, oh, will you play with me? You know, but my kids have the most fun on their own when I demonstrate a new way to play with their toys or like, how about trying this? And then they'll just play because they, you know, you facilitate an activity. I do it. We do it together. Then you do it. And then they go off and play. But yeah, if you think about give them a stick and a rock, but you have a whole society who for 1600 years has facilitated gamified learning. I want to be there. Yeah. We'd be geniuses.
We would learn a lot.
Oh, my God.
The thing that stuck out the most to me about that part was that the time immemorial, that if it's not the standard way, it's substandard. I remember that when I made my own baby food. I know this is a weird analogy, but somehow, I mean, people, aren't you worried about them not getting enough nutrition? Like somehow, you know, jarred baby food was going to be more nutritious than homemade.
But this had extra lead in it.
I couldn't trust, but that's the immediate response to that kind of education. Mm-hmm. You know, the old schoolmaster and, you know, keep the kids in line was always the superior, I get here, air quotes, superior way of teaching. So it would come as a surprise to outsiders that it would game. Play.
Well, that comes up a lot. It's like, we just play really old games. That's, you know, you're like sticks and dirt and like hopscotch and stuff like that. We don't create new games. Kids just keep playing old games. Also, like old religious values, you know.
Well, that's what most of our games probably are, to teach social norms.
Yes.
As opposed to teach something constructive.
Right. Creative thinking.
Here, play with the pink shit.
Quantitative analysis. There you go. All these useful things. Okay, it's time to transition to pseudoscience time.
Time to break the internet.
So a highly problematic and racist aspect of Charlotte's belief system, which has to be recognized, is she is a strong believer in the efficacy of eugenics. So this may sound familiar because Nazis, you know.
Maybe that's why I thought it was so airy.
Oh, yeah. So it has all the vibes, right? Eugenics is the belief that the human race can be perfected through genetics and heredity. So, quote unquote, unfit individuals are removed from the gene pool either by not being allowed to be reproduce or being sterilized or through social exclusion. So Charlotte takes this belief and puts a feminist spin on it, which potentially makes it more palatable, question mark. Creates a world where women are able to reproduce asexually, so
parthenogenesis.
But it is clearly problematic anyway, and it's clearly to me still has an Aryan, pun intended, tint to it, because of her word choices. You know, the frequent use of the word savage, the idea that the early version of this now perfect race had a harem bred society, so they weren't even exposed to, you know, the riffraff. You know, what is it? The world, you know, cisgender couples and, you know, oh, they're just wild and, you know, feral. And
this made me think of something, but finish your
yeah, race. So she just demonstrated the common belief that at the time that the ideal race is, you know, very, very white, very Western tradition. Mm-hmm. Because just a lot of negative connotations for both the history of the people preceding her land.
Right.
And also just her word choice in general, just like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, there were some archaisms
in yes.
here. I'm just wondering, given the location of this, is there hidden society Atlantis?
Ooh. I never it thought of that
cut
before.
Off from other
so instead
people,
of going underwater, it went above?
It went up and got isolated. That would fit the Atlantis myth.
Does the Atlantis myth include like a war? I know it involved a dramatic like you know
catastrophic global change.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm just like when it taught, and I'm just wondering because the Atlanteans supposedly were more Aryan, like a more white super race, whatever, and it would fit. That's one of the only groups of super white people at that point in history. Ever imagined to be in the Americas.
I didn't think about that, but that could be like a reimagining of the myth of Atlantis.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I could see that.
I just thought of that as you were going through your eugenics.
Yeah.
Piece.
Yeah. So, yes, she was a eugenicist. She did have a problematic history related to other races, though there were pieces in here where it talked about a diversity of skin color among women, yes. depending upon where they lived.
Because they kept the slaves.
Yes, they did. Yes. Yeah, they kept the women who did not like fight back or and then contributed to the society agriculturally and things like that. So, question mark. It was not super clear. It still all gave Aryan vibes to me. So.
Yeah, and we didn't really talk about. You think about something like cheetahs, where cheetahs are 100% genetically identical because mm-hmm. they have such a small breeding population and that's causing them
to die.
Trauma.
Yeah.
3 million, maybe you wouldn't run into those same problems, but if you take a relatively small population and you add parthenogenesis to it, where there's no genetic diversity being introduced from person to person,
mm-hmm.
I have a hard time stomaching parthenogenesis tomorrow.
Well, maybe it's futuristic celestial parthenogenesis.
There's... Yes, it's alien.
Yeah. I had one other piece that was science related, and it was more the anti-abortion piece. Science.
Yes, that was she was very strong.
Yeah, so very strong anti-abortion belief system. It was specifically on like page 130 in my text. I wanted to. Because so in my previous readings, this did not hit me the same way than a recent reading has.
Our society is definitely in a time of debate about this.
Yes,
issue.
With our society, you know, just now it's not legal at the federal level to have an abortion, and all that like access to abortion is so specific and state issues.
20 minutes that way.
It's yeah. Illegal. Mm-hmm. So there's a conversation going on between. It's Van and one of the teachers. So it's talking about mothers and how people become mothers and how many children they can bear in society and things like that. But what I do not understand naturally is how you prevent it. I gather that each woman had 5. You have no tyrannical husbands to hold in check, and you surely do not destroy the unborn. So he was trying to understand how they controlled how many kids they have, right? And so the teacher... The look of ghastly horror she gave me, I shall never forget. She started from her chair, pale, her eyes blazing. Destroy the unborn, she said in a hard whisper. Do men do that in your country? Men, I began to answer rather hotly, and then saw the gulf before me. None of us wanted these women to think our women, of whom we boasted so proudly, were in any way inferior to them. I'm ashamed to say that I equivocated. I told her of certain criminal types of women, perverts or crazy, who had been known to commit infanticide. I told her truly enough that there was much in our land which was open to criticism, but that I hated to dwell on our defects until they understood us and our conditions better. And making a wide detour, I scrambled back to my question of how they limited the population. So only women, crazy perverts could possibly want an abortion in the first place. Just like, you know, they are genetically defective on their own. having wanted one in the first place.
Yeah, they wouldn't even be allowed to breed.
Right? Yeah, so...
Oh, problem solved.
Very anti-abortion, because I'm not exactly sure of the, like, technology at that time, but women did use herbal remedies to prevent pregnancy at early stages and things like that. But there was really... And Charlotte Perkins Gilman was in a more privileged sect of society. You know, her family was not impoverished. She had education. She knew and had access to women who were educated, who were published writers. So I feel like she had issues maybe understanding why someone
how you get there
would not want to have kids, not affording kids, mm-hmm. things like that. So I think that was a problematic piece of her lens, mm-hmm. for sure.
It's the social gulf between her yeah. and the people who would need. Which right. they do address. We're not in the science section, but we'll get there, I think. They address so much of the discrepancies between their society.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Which I think are fascinating. So,
yeah.
Any science you want to add there, Rena? Bovina?
Banana, fana, fofina.
You guys pretty much cover it.
My wife is Adelina Mabel Warren Hagstrom.
Well, if you're going to make a wish, wish for some damn money, will you?
So, word processor of the gods. Stuff that really tickled our fancy.
Everything. Pretty
the
much.
The whole thing tickled mm-hmm. Rick's fancy. Mm-hmm. I got one passage because I gave one away already.
Oh, yeah, do it.
The child entered upon a broad, open field of life in which motherhood was the one great personal contribution to the national life, and all the rest of the individual share in their common activities. Every girl I talked to at any age above babyhood had her cheerful determination as to what she was going to be when she grew up. What Terry meant by saying they had no modesty was that this great life view had no shady places. They had a high sense of personal decorum, but no shame, no knowledge of anything to be ashamed of. Even their shortcomings and misdeeds in childhood never were presented to them as sins, merely as errors and misplaces in a game. Some of them, who were palpably less agreeable than others, or who had a real weakness or fault, were treated with cheerful allowance, as if a friendly group at whist would treat a poor player. Their religion, you see, was maternal, and their ethics, based on the full perception of evolution, showed the principle of growth and the beauty of wise culture. They had no theory of the essential opposition of good and evil. Life to them was growth. Their pleasure was in growing, and their duty also. I find that quite beautiful.
I love that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just the whole growth mindset and people mm-hmm. who are struggling or maybe more negative things, so that you're understanding, you give them grace.
It's a teachable moment.
It's love. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's an entire society built around like the maternal love, even for women who were not going to be able to have children, they still were given the opportunity to love and have that mother love.
Yeah.
With each other.
No, I think it's quite lovely. I understand why you like this book.
It's beautiful.
Despite the eugenics.
I know. Which every subsequent read of it, I'm just like, I feel like you wish you could edit it out, but you can't do that. one of my favorite passages is when they talk about how her land came to be.
I did not read this with these questions in mind, so I apologize. I'm not as prepared.
So one of my favorite passages is in the book where the women of Herland are sharing the history of how their world came to be. So at first there was a period of sheer despair. The mountains towered between them and their old enemies, but also between them and escape. There was no way up or down or out. They simply had to stay there. Some were for suicide, but not the majority. They must have been a plucky lot as a whole, and they decided to live as long as they did live. Of course, they had hope, as youth must, that something would happen to change their fate. So they set to work, to bury the dead, to plow and sow, to care for one another, which I made a note. The constant plight of women, to pick up the pieces after war. Side note. Speaking of burying the dead, I will set down, while I think of it, that they had adopted cremation in about the 13th century for the same reason they had left off raising cattle. They could not spare the room. They were much surprised to learn that we were still burying. Asking our reasons for it, and were much dissatisfied with what we gave. We told them of the belief in the resurrection of the body. I love this part. And they asked, if our God was not as well able to resurrect ashes as from long corruption. And they asked if our, yeah. We told them of how people thought it repugnant to have their loved ones burn, and they asked if it was less repugnant to have them decay. They were inconveniently reasonable, these women. Mm-hmm. I just, well, that part just cracks me up. Inconveniently unreasonable. It's just, I wish I had read that when I was younger and could have had that conversation with my sexist, belligerent pastor. I just wish I had Charlotte Perkins Gilman in my mind.
It was quite funny.
That was so funny. Yeah, I had so many. I like, there's one passage on page 124. You see, they had no wars. They had had no kings and no priests and no aristocracies. They were sisters. And as they grew together, not by competition, but by united action. Just like, oh, I just love it. It's just freaking beautiful.
We walked through the night and made it back to Castle Rock a little past 5 o'clock on Sunday morning, the day before Labor Day. We'd only been gone 2 days, but somehow the town seemed different, smaller.
Well, so we move into fan humanoid moment because
we've all of it. I'm a fan. I'm fan humanoiding all over the place here. Yeah, let's do it.
I think for me, the favorite thing was the contrast between their society and ours. You'll find they have their faults too, Terry insisted, and partly in self-defense. We all three began to look for those faults of theirs. We had been very strong on this subject before we got there, and those baseless speculations of ours. So it's just, the whole book is really about contrasting where they were in society, in America in particular, was what she writes about, and this utopian world. And I found that that was, like, I would love to take more time and do like a deep dive into like a one-to-one comparison of all the things that were different. I think maybe she did that in her essays. I have not read her essays, but just to look at, here's what we have, here's what we could do, like in religion and in education and all of those fields, would be very fascinating to see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that would be a good contrast or comparison as well, because if you think about how, you know, our existence sometimes is like our accidental existence. Mm-hmm. I term it, like, we go through life and we do the things that the way we do them because that's the way they've always been done. Mm-hmm. But I looked at things like their thinking ahead of, well, we've got limited real estate, so mm-hmm. why don't we plant trees that will feed us and then systematically replace all of those? Mm-hmm. So thinking about that from an environmental perspective.
Cows take up too much resources, so
exactly
off of the cows.
Exactly. So that by default, because of what the land will support, mm-hmm. Will become vegetarians.
Yeah. And in that way, she's caught up to us and ahead of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We are not where we need to be in terms of sustainable agriculture and foodstuffs.
But the way that they approached, okay, they didn't freak out. These men are here now. Mm-hmm. And the first thing that they wanted to do, and I love this, is that we want to teach you our ways mm-hmm. through our actions, but you learn our language. Mm-hmm. I mean, they made the effort to learn English as well,
and
but
faster than the men. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But make them, you know, forcing them to be able to communicate so that they could, you know, answer questions so they could become conversant. But mm-hmm. it's almost like they were spoiled children. Like, no, come back over here. You know, they were never prisoners, but it's like, no, you're missing the point. Come on. Go, mm-hmm. you know,
uh-huh. the same way they guided their intuition.
Right. Mm-hmm. And they knew where they were at the whole time.
Well, when they escaped, that was hilarious. Yeah. Terry got so mad because he thought he was some sort of like sneaky Mission Impossible moment.
Yeah.
You know, hiding through the underbrush. They were watching them the whole time, making sure they had enough food.
Yeah.
It's just so emasculating. I was like, that is fantastic.
Well, what's hilarious too is that it just disabling them simply by making it
like covering their airplane in canvas, sewing their plane shut so that they couldn't get.
They're like, well, the only way they can get down
right
is with their machine.
Right.
We'll just make it so they can't get into their machine.
Right.
Duh.
Without a pair of scissors.
The whole society works smarter, not harder. And these guys are just struggle bus. All they want is struggle. And that's a big crux issue in the book. I did have one about patriotism. Which I thought was one of my, especially right now where patriotism is such like a toxic concept, or it is rough right now. They loved one another with a practically universal affection, rising to exquisite and unbroken friendships and broadening to a devotion to their country and people for which our word patriotism is no definition at all. Patriotism, red hot, is compatible with the existence of a neglect of national interests, a dishonesty, a cold indifference to the suffering of millions. Patriotism is largely pride and very largely combativeness. Patriotism generally has a chip on its shoulder. I was like, oh!
Put that on a t-shirt.
Preach! I wrote next to it, oh my God, yep. Put
that on a t-shirt. I did capture a list of the contrasts.
Oh, yes.
So, suppose there is a country of women only, Jeff had put it over and over. What'll they be like? And we had been cocksure as to the inevitable limitations, the faults and vices of a lot of women. We had expected them to be given over to what we called feminine vanity, frills and furbelows, and we found that they had evolved a costume more perfect than the Chinese dress, richly beautiful and so desired, always useful, of unfailing dignity and good taste. We had expected a dull, submissive monotony, and found a daring social inventiveness far beyond our own, and a mechanical and scientific development fully equal to ours. We had expected pettiness and found a social consciousness besides which our nations looked like quarreling children, feeble-minded ones at that. We had expected jealousy and found a broad sisterly affection, a fair-minded intelligence to which we could produce no parallel. We had expected hysteria and found a standard of health and vigor, a calmness of temper to which the habit of profanity, for instance, was impossible to explain. We tried it. All of these things, even Terry had to admit, but he still insisted that we would find out the other side pretty soon.
Oh, Terry.
Just love that part.
Oh, yeah. It does really quantify it. Mm-hmm. But I think the reason why I keep coming back to this book is how logical, how organized, mm-hmm. how...
rational.
How all of these things that women are not given as mm-hmm. you know, stereotypical attributes demonstrated in this. And in my daily life, I think about how in my partnership, which I have a man as my husband. So, you know, I am the logical
not
one.
A Terry.
I am not a Terry. No, he's actually more like, I don't know. He's not like either of those characters. He's a feminist or he would not have ended up with me. But, you know, I'm the logical one. I'm the planner. I am the primary breadwinner. I, you know, like have some technical, I have a lot of technical skills, you know. So a lot of these things that are being demonstrated in society that were very avant-garde for the time, showing that women could do these things, are things that I do, but also socially don't always get credit for, you know, I feel like. So just, yeah. I like living in this world. Is why I keep coming back to this book.
Interesting. Any fan moments for you before we go on to slightly less fanny things?
I think I've kind of encapsulated it before, just that comparison of what a calm, subjective view that they had, you know, as they questioned him. I guess it's kind of funny that after a while, they learned to not question them about certain things because those questions would always be brought back to them.
Thrown back.
Yeah. So I don't know. I thought about just the overarching, the idea of what's possible, of stripping out all of those cultural norms or those presuppositions about what women will be like Terry would never truly believed that all of this was possible. Yeah.
They're not womanly.
Any of you all know what a sundown town is?
Yes, sir, we do.
Well, this is a sundown county. And if I had found you pissing in my woods like animals after dark, it would have been my sworn duty to hang every single one of you from them trees.
It's not sundown yet.
All right, I know Britt's not going to have any answers for this. We're at the 404 page not found. poorly written passages, and we'll just lump in Lost in Space, which are things so far out there you can't believe them. And I have a little bit there. Lovecraft, which are cringy passages, and ironically enough, asexual reproduction, which is the theme of
that part made me laugh too. Like,
so anything that's so far out.
Well, the cringy part, anything with the word savages in it was just, you know.
Yeah, there's plenty of cringy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And again, you take it in the spirit of somebody writing in the early 1900s, every book written in that time period, it's the same stereotypes and tropes mm-hmm. and all that about minoritized people.
Yes. So
I mm-hmm. think we have not escaped that even in a very forward-looking feminist positive book. Mm-hmm. That was challenging. The science piece, I don't know that I ever heard of anybody who had a pocket biplane that they assembled out of a backpack and mm-hmm. they would fly three people anywhere.
Squirrel suit? Question mark?
And a hard time imagining that. But I didn't have a ton of other things that were just so far out there, aside from the dynamics of having all the men killed, including the boy children, I guess, so that only the women were left in this isolated place. And maybe I misread that.
So, yeah. So it was there. All of the fighting age males mm-hmm. left through this valley, right? And then there was a like lava earthquake, mm-hmm. you know, catastrophic event. And then the people that were left, there were, I believe, enslaved men mm-hmm. and young men who were like both enslaved and non-enslaved young men and children who were male, right. who were part of the society. And so I believe the enslaved men of fighting age who were not at the war killed all of the young boys and then tried to take over society. Like they killed all of the boys okay. who were part of the, the society that was in power.
Structure, yeah.
Yes. And so
the slave uprising.
Yes. The slave uprising. Enslaved person uprising killed all of the young boys. And then when the women uprose against the...
They re-rose
up against the enslaved uprising and killed all of the men. Because the only adult of fighting age men, I believe, that were left over were the enslaved men. Okay. And so then all that was left were women and female children, okay. both enslaved, who were once enslaved or who were part of the powerful society.
Interesting.
That is okay. what I think happened.
Okay.
And then they said that there were women who were pregnant and had babies at that time who had been impregnated yeah. the normal way, quote unquote. But the only male baby died.
Okay. That was a long time ago.
Yeah. So there's that we read this book enough. Apparently, I got it. It's got its own special space in my brain.
Yeah,
but
written in a time where there weren't, despite it being entirely about asexual reproduction, there weren't really racy parts. Mm-mm. So we can just kind of
no. Oh well, yeah. Except for the Lovecraft cringy part was I think it was cringy in that it was pretty glossed over. Was Terry's attempted rape of Olima.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the part that makes me mad at Van, mm-hmm. actually, because, you know, he tends to be neutral as sociologist, blah, blah, blah. He totally takes off his sociologist hat and totally identifies with Terry. And I wrote U next to it. Where did
I... Looking for the U in your book.
Da-da-da-da-da. He starts talking about he can't think of a similar case in history and all of fiction. Women have killed themselves rather than to submit to the outrage of being raped. It never calls it rape. And the word rape is never in here, not in the word assault, nothing. So he totally...
Fascinating she wouldn't call that out.
Right? So he says, well, it was hard. So this is Van talking about poor Terry. He was madly in love with Olima, really, more so than he had ever been before, and their tempestuous courtship, quarrels, and reconciliations had fanned the flame. And then, when he sought by that supreme conquest, which seemed so natural a thing to that type of man, to force her to love him as her master, to have the sturdy, athletic, furious woman rise up and master him, she and her friends, it was no wonder he raged.
Yeah.
He like... raged. That's the euphemism for rape in the book.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
All right. Crazy plot twists? Not so much.
Mm-mm. film.
We watched as the bombs shattered the second comet into a million pieces of ice and rock that burned harmlessly in our atmosphere and lit up the sky for an hour.
All right. Do you have Deep Impact stuff before I go on to Bowie and then we rate this?
So I think it was deeply impactful at the time. You know, this was 5 years before women gained the ability to vote. I wonder in that time period, a woman writing about an imaginative world where women have power over everything, power over their own bodies, power over their, like, but power over decisions, power over, you know, channeling their professions and their interests and having access to education and, while also being able to be maternal and caring, like all these things is very much a dreamscape for women at this time period. And it was also everyone was healthy. Everyone had access to food and, you know, nourishment and housing, and it's clean and it's beautiful. So this would have been a very like egalitarian, beautiful, imaginative world that I think would have given women an opportunity to think outside of their scope, and I think it would have been highly impactful.
Yeah.
And I would say maybe, you know, was a treatise on, hey, this is why we should get the power to vote, because if women have a say in society, maybe we could get our world to look more like this.
Sure. Yeah.
Danger, Will Robinson. Danger. No, Will Robinson. Danger.
But I know you're only thinking of David Bowie, right?
No, I was actually thinking of a plot twist in that how in so many years there was never really a famine or a drought or another plague of locusts or anything that caused conflict and strife within their perfect utopian society.
No, they said they had this, that moth, right?
Yeah, they had a moth, but they exterminated.
Yeah, they exterminated the moth, but even when they found a female moth that had the potential to like wipe out all of their trees, they were so calm about it.
Right.
They just like told all the children to watch out for this moth. And
I don't see 1600 years of nothing catastrophic
happening. Yeah, no other massive apocalyptic, you know, movement of tectonic plates.
Right.
Question mark.
We've already had one major event.
Never again. You're obviously on some sort of tectonic plate for that to happen in the first place, but never again.
Do we have deep impact, cultural impact of this? We talked about it at the beginning, except for just moving.
I think maybe we can say that she affected the women's ability to get the vote.
Oh, I thought you meant to reproduce asexually.
That would be less fun. But so practical, so practical. Okay, yeah. Where's Bowie, Justin?
Where is Bowie?
Well, for those of you who may be new to listening to us, Justin's whole reason probably for this podcast was to find Bowie in everything we read. So Deep Impact, trace the cultural impact of the work and find out how this is somehow connected to Bowie.
David Bowie. It was republished in the 1970s, which was the time when the women's power movement was at its height. She was, of course, involved in the women's power movement, women's rights movement, and the first suffrages convention in 1886. She also published an article titled A Protest Against Petticoats, in which she argued that restrictive dress contributed to the over-sexualization of women.
Preach.
That's her. But Bowie, strangely enough, derived much of his late life spirituality from the work of Charlotte Perkins Gilman.
You're joking me.
I kid you not.
I don't believe you.
Because here we have...
What?
Much of his late life spiritual philosophy was derived from Gilman, specifically the idea of a creation-creative birth-based religion.
Ooh.
So, which Gilman hints at in the book and fully proposes in His Religion and Hers, which is an article she wrote, or an essay. Some of the focus is on the blurring of boundaries between the creator and the created. And that's really all I got. But he was a fan, and his beliefs about his own role as an artist and a creator meld some of her ideas about creation and how creation is a spiritual activity and the kind of should be the focus of life and religiosity.
Oh, I like it. Yeah, I like the way you took that. He was influenced by her, mm-hmm. you know, because she was born and died before he was around. So she could not be influenced by him.
They did not know each other.
They did not know each other. I think she would have liked him.
Influenced by him.
I think she might have liked him.
Because he's a space-time traveling alien.
He could have.
Pew-pews!
Oh.
We rate each book on a scale of 1 to 5 pew-pews. That would mean a perfect rating would be 10 pew noises. Pew, 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 pew.
One being a pew, pew.
One being a pew, pew.
Very poor.
Yeah.
Is a one.
You want to start, Rena? We'll let Britt go last.
Okay. Well, my pew, pews maybe not, might not be a fair assessment because I didn't realize this was part of a trilogy because I got to the end and went,
Ending was very abrupt. Yes.
Very abrupt. Because my copy had several pages of reference and footnotes and stuff. So when I saw that last one, I was like, no, wait, there's more pages. I would say, pew, 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 pew.
Three pew-pews.
Three pew-pews. Okay. Pew-pews.
Fair enough.
Yeah, I...
you get to go last.
Oh, I get to go last. Go ahead.
I'm also going to go pew-pew, 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 three pew-pews. I thought it was a really good book. I'm happy I finally read it.
Mm-hmm.
I really appreciate the premise. I appreciate the idea of being able to show the challenges that we have or they had in their society we still have now with a juxtaposition of a more utopian society, like most utopian novels. It was good. Mm-hmm. I would like to have some more conflict, a little more dark, a little more science.
Okay, dude.
Like, I always want that
stuff.
What a
man. Just to get struggle, conflict.
I feel like the Salt and Pepper song.
So before I can pew-pew, I have to say I had like my jump the shark thing was the fact that it ended so abruptly.
Yes.
You know, it ends with, Terry, we're not going to let you leave unless you promise not to say anything. You're like, okay. And like then we let them leave.
And then they left. By
and I'm just like, you know he's not going to keep his promise. He's a sketchy dude.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that, I never liked the end of that. So that, I was happy when I found out there was a sequel. Yeah. But I would give it pew pew, pew pew, pew pew, pew pew, pew.
Wow,
4.5 pews. I readily admit my bias. I love this book. I've read it five times.
Favorites.
I've studied it. I'm aware of its shortcomings, but I think that a book that still people talk about, you know, in their everyday life that orbits, yeah, has orbited mm-hmm. your life for many years that you've never read, a book that still feels futuristic, not because of the unrealistic, like high plateau unattainableness of it physically, but how futuristic it seems socially, and just the way that society is organized that way, just to me, just still hits. And it, every time I read it, it hits harder, especially now with, you know, women's access to healthcare in 2024, the way politics plays out and the idea of patriotism and things like that. It's still just...
There's a lot of themes in there that are completely identified to superimpose on any time period, really.
Yeah, it still hit a few times. It just hit me right in the diaphragm. Like, woof, you know, it just... Yeah. Threw me back, and every time I read it.
We haven't gotten better.
No, we've not done
further
better.
Away, maybe in the last 10 years.
I think Charlotte Perkins Gilman would be kind of sad because there's still articles in the New York Times about how, you know, birth rates are lower and lower because of the inegalitarian nature of like family and family responsibilities. You know, women are still working full-time jobs and then also still primary yep. caregivers doing most of the child care, being in charge of their education and taking more time off or missing work more to take care of kids. 2024. So this, I think she would be disappointed.
Yeah.
But I'm never disappointed when I read this book.
Good book. Short read, quick read. Read the book. Our next episode will be... something holiday.
We don't know. Having trouble picking for the holidays, but maybe that's a little
plug.
The little surprise.
Yes.
We're just going to be a holiday surprise. Neutral surprise. Yes. You know, religiously neutral festival.
Hanukkah
surprise.
And Christmas happen at the same time this year, so it'll be a Jewish Christian themed holiday sci-fi book.
Yep, we don't know.
As soon as we find that book, we'll read the heck out of it.
Thank you for listening. In the basement, where the nerds reside, we gather round with a wicked stride. With our books in hand, we start to dive into dystopian worlds that come alive.